Hello again, and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Bout.
And I'm Gautam Wolf.
And we're back discussing the European Green Deal and how to make it work with two authors of our recent paper, How to Make the European Green Deal Work. I'm joined by Gregory Claes. Hello, Gregory.
Hello.
And Simone Tagli-Petra.
Hello.
And Georg Zachmann also worked on this paper. Unfortunately, he can't be here today, but we note his contribution. So fear not if you did not catch part one of this two-part podcast. They are not in any particular order. We have four pillars in our list of prescriptions for a European Green Deal. It doesn't matter which order you listen to them, but I think you'd gain a lot by listening to both podcasts in whatever order. One of the things we didn't mention in the first podcast, we went straight into our prescriptions. We didn't really talk about the scale of the challenge so much. Now, as of today, time of recording, we have 11,007 days until the start of 2050. Now, if we want to meet our current energy needs around the world in time for that, we need to build approximately one nuclear power station every day for all of those days, or 1,500 wind turbines. It's a huge challenge. Simone, how do we look at numbers like this and not be absolutely terrified and deterred from trying to make a difference?
It's a revolution. It's a revolution because this implies a structural change in the economy and in the society. That's exactly why we have nowadays these initiatives that are very holistic, in the sense that are not just looking at climate and energy policy anymore, which used to be the case up to, I would say, last year. We used to tackle these issues from a climate perspective only, from an energy policy perspective only. Now there is a clear recognition that we can only be able to achieve climate neutrality by 2050 if we really put this initiative into scale and if we reach out to all the components of our economic system, notably the industry. That's why industrial policy is an important component of the Green Deal. And of course, also if we look at the distributional effects of climate policy, so how to ensure that we leave no one behind in the transition.
If I may, that's why our four pillars are really complementary, and that's why it's not about climate policy. The first pillar is really classic climate policy, but it's true that the second one is investment policy, which was generally more of a macro policy. The third one is industrial policy, which used to be also very separated from the other pillars. And the last one is social policy. So generally we saw them in silos, and here we use all the potential levers at our disposal to tackle climate change.
On the order of magnitude, I think that Greg can give you one number on the investment requirements.
No, on the magnitude, what we mentioned in the paper is this 300 billion number per year of additional investment. And it's a huge number. And actually, this number is for a target of 40% reduction
by 2030.
If we go to this minus 50 or minus 55%, we might have even higher numbers, like 320, 400 billion per year of additional needs in terms of investment.
But still, I mean, the magnitude of the challenge is really, it sounds so big, doesn't it? I mean, it's in 30 years, zero net emissions. I mean, I look out of the door, there's only combustion engined cars, I mean, fueled cars. How on earth are we gonna make it in Europe? How can we ever achieve such ambitious targets?
Well, my point would be, look back at what we did with the electricity system over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, wind energy, solar energy were still niche. Now they are mainstream. And just to give you one simple number, think about the fact that the cost of a solar panel has declined by 95% of the last 10 years. So the speed of the technological development in this field is astonishing. And this is playing in favor of the viability of these initiatives if the current policy frameworks are put in place.
Okay, so let's perhaps zoom in a little bit on the industrial policy side, because that's, I think, an important aspect you emphasize very much in your paper as a way of speeding up, if I understand correctly, the technological change also. And in a sense, you had one big experiment on this, which was the German Energiewende during energy transition, during which Germany massively subsidized solar panels. And arguably, that was a big industrial policy because it actually helped the world to advance with solar panel energy. And in the end, actually, there's no solar panel producers anymore in Germany. So it was a huge subsidy to the rest of the world. Perhaps the EU and Germany gave back what we emitted more than the rest of the world. But is that the kind of industrial policy that you have in mind? I mean, what kind of industrial policy makes sense where we speed up technological change, but where we also, as Europeans, benefit from it in terms of our industry?
Well, in principle, we believe that the European Green Deal can only work if it really takes on board the industry. We need to make sure that this transformation towards climate neutrality is an industrial success. Now, the question is how to do that. We see three different levels of action there. The first is to promote disruptive innovation. We in Europe are good about innovation in, for example, certain sectors like the automotive industry, biopharma, and so on and so forth. But we have been lagging behind in sectors from digital to renewable energy and batteries and electric cars. So we need to catch up by fostering disruptive innovation in this field. We need to be innovative exactly as other players such as the United States are in this field. Second, we need to create a market in Europe for innovative products. And third, we need to export the European Green Deal. So we need to promote our companies that produce green stuff to move beyond the European borders and access emerging markets that are quickly rising in a way that they can feel comfortable to make investments there. So these are the three dimensions of the industrial policy for the Green Deal as we see it.
So, Gregory, are we producing a public good for the world with this industrial policy, or are we creating business opportunity for European business, or both?
I think we need to do both, and I think that's why actually our two of our pillars are complementary. We need to invest in Europe, and we need to invest in innovation. I think industrial policy and investment policy are complementary. And what we say in the paper in the industrial policy part is that, for instance, we need to boost innovation in Europe, and for that we could use, for instance, existing fund. We always try to use for existing tools. And for instance, we think that we should boost the European Innovation Council and the Innovation Fund, which already exist and should be used actually to finance innovation in Europe. And actually, it's again complementary to the investment plan, because here it's really finance industrial innovation. And again, I think that the advice that we give in the investment part are also similar to the ones that we give in the industrial part, because we say for investment, we need really to invest in risky, innovative products. That's what we say when we discuss InvestEU. And here it's the same. We really mention that if we want to really create innovations that are disruptive and that really will tackle climate change, we need to be ready actually to lose some money sometimes. We need to be ready to fail sometimes, and that's absolutely necessary.
We quote Roderick on this on the paper when he says that failure is part of a successful industrial policy, because if you don't,
Danny Roderick,
because if you don't fail, it means that you are not taking the risks that are necessary to push for the frontier innovation in this field. And what Gregory said is exactly very much to the point. And I would just like to stress that two are the dimensions for innovation here. One is to foster innovation in the also in the big incumbents, in the big, very energy intensive industry we have today in Europe. And for that, the innovation fund under the ETS is particularly important, because it really helps the industry to demonstrate projects such as carbon capture and sequestration that are fundamental to decarbonize industries such as steel, cements, and so on and so forth. And this is also an incentive for the industry to stay in Europe while the carbon price goes up, so can also provide really a response to the carbon leakage problem that otherwise should be dealt with a border adjustment measure. Second, the disruptive innovation. The European Innovation Council is a facility that has been created and is still in pilot project nowadays. It resembles the DARPA agency in the United States. It's an agency that is has become very famous also thanks to the narrative built by Mariana Mazzucato in this field, because it's the agency that really promoted innovation that led to the internet, to the many components of the iPhone and so on and so forth. We always wanted, that's also what Macron most recently proposed, a European DARPA. This European Innovation Council should be the European DARPA. We think that this idea is sensible. We should put more money under Horizon 2020 Horizon Europe for this initiative, and we need to make sure that a substantial part of this initiative is for green technologies.
For most of my lifetime, at least in my country, government seems to have taken a very hands-off approach to industrial policy, and it's kind of just outsourced how industry works to the free market. Does this mean that in the decades to come, we're going to kind of swing back in the other direction, have much more state involvement in industry across Europe?
In my view, the governments should not be there to judge technologies or to favor one industrial process rather than another one. But governmental policies are key to provide the sense of direction to the industry, to give really a sense that the world is moving in one direction and the industry should follow. And this is of paramount importance. And then there is another topic which, in our view, is particularly relevant here, which refers to the coordination of the national industrial policies. Because it is not that we don't have industrial policy in Europe right now. We have 28 industrial policies because each country has its own industrial policy, because, of course, it is seen as a matter of national sovereignty and national strong interest. What we need to ensure is that this fragmentation of industrial policies in Europe is not fragmenting the single market and is not detrimental for the EU as a whole, while we have to compete with big, far bigger players like China and the United States.
And that's why we need to coordinate, basically. Exactly. Yeah, because not having a single market for those technology is a problem.
Okay, but still, I mean, I think Nicolas' question is a very good one. So, a sense of direction, yes, but what does that actually mean? Does it mean that the EU commissioner should choose what technology we use? Should he choose or she choose whether or not we go for electric cars or hybrid hybrid cells cars? Is that the kind of choice and the kind of direction that should be given? Or what really is the industrial policy after? I mean, you have to take technological choices, and who's taking these choices? And who's actually saying this was the wrong choice and is accepting the failure? I mean, how can the political system come to that point, which Danny Roderick nicely formulates? I mean, of course, industrial policy means accepting failure. But notoriously, politicians who have bet on a horse won't accept that this horse is actually the wrong horse. So how do we deal with accepting failure, and how do we choose the right technology? I mean, isn't it in the end still much more about general innovation funding and framework conditions? I mean, what really is the industrial policy
here? I would really see it also from a mission-oriented perspective, because if you take the example of batteries, for instance, there are many kinds of batteries that goes from lithium to the new generations of solid-state batteries. What Europe has been trying to do over the last year is to set up this European Battery Alliance that has resulted in a strong cooperation between France, Germany, also Italy and other countries now in this field, and we start to see gigafactories being built in Germany, while this was seen as impossible a few years ago. So there is the possibility to push countries to cooperate in fields in which we have not been really experts so far, but we do have the know-how and the technological capability to enter new fields that were left, in this case, to the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Koreans over the last years.
Well, I think the question is, can you have a successful European Green Deal without a significant concentration of power? Anybody care to?
Well, so significant power in the sense of concentration of specific innovation activities in just one or two countries, because I mean, one of the problems, of course, of the EU budget, as we know, is that well, there is the principle of redistribution. There's also the principle of, well, we want to innovate and pay for the best, right? But that principle is often undermined because of the power politics and making the budget add up. So to concentrate resources, you need to concentrate power. And are we actually going to be able to do this with the current EU budget discussion the way you see them?
But in our paper, I don't think we advocate for concentration of power. I think, yeah, the role that we give to the EU and to the Commission in particular is to coordinate also national policies in general and to arrive to harmonized standards, etc.
Also because if you, for example, take the example of the automotive industry, value chains are really now widespread across Europe. So we have thinking about that last year with a paper also published with Renil de Wegelers here at Bruegel, and we tracked the value chains of the automotive industry in Europe, and you really see that much of the components that are used then in Germany for the assembly are made in Slovakia rather than in Poland. So there is a European value chain, and with think that we should build on this.
And one of the things we're going to need is a new culture of procurement.
Absolutely. That's a fundamental ingredient for the market creation. When I was saying that three are the levels, the second one is the creation of a market for innovative products. And this basically means that it's not sufficient to push innovation, because even if you have the best inventions, the best innovative products, but there is no market for them, this is not a successful industrial policy. So we need to ensure that there is a receptive market for innovative products. And one prescription that is the typical Brussels bubble prescription is you have to complete the single market, but we go beyond and we say, well, why don't we also make a better use of public procurement? Public procurement in Europe represents 16% of the European economy. It's a large share. So think if we make use of public procurement rules to push, for example, for clean cars rather than renewable energy technologies, this would represent a fundamental way to create a primary market for these products that would allow the European companies and other companies to get the scale necessary to then move to the wider market. This is, in our view, a very sensible tool.
But can I push you a bit on this? I mean, yeah. Sure. I mean, having some sort of common procurement will be extremely strong demand factor on the industry, because the public sector is just so big as someone demanding, for example, cars. I mean, think of all the public cars that are being used in the police departments and so on and so forth. I mean, this is a huge demand pull. So if they were all to buy electric cars, that would be great for the industry and great for developing that industry. Yet, all of these national police offices and so on have been looking into this, and very often they take explicit choices not to buy an electric car, because the electric car still does not fulfill the criteria that are needed for a police car, such as a certain driving range. So aren't you in a sense putting the cart before the horses? I mean, if the technology is not there yet, and if things are not fulfilling the criteria, well, why should the public sector actually take a hit and have suboptimal products?
But, you know, I come from Italy, as you can hear from my voice, probably my pronunciation.
That's okay.
And in
I'm
Italy,
from Germany, so my voice is also.
And in Italy, police have all kinds of cars, from a small Fiat Panda up to the Lamborghini. We are not claiming that the police should replace the Lamborghini with an electric car tomorrow, but they can start by replacing the Fiat Pandas tomorrow with a Lamborghini, so a small car. So this is just to say that we should not push necessarily...
Sorry, they should replace the Lamborghini with an electric car, with a Tesla.
not the Lamborghini, but they can start with the small cars for the city centers. That's possible as a first step.
Okay.
So that's my point. And we should not,
So the cheap Fiat Panda gets replaced with an expensive i3.
Renault Zoe.
BMW i3.
With a Renault Zoe.
With a Renault Zoe. Okay.
There are also cheaper cars. And right, but the point here is we don't even need to be prescriptive on the model of electric cars or electric cars themselves. We just need to put clear parameters, for example, about emission standards. So if we put tough emission standards for public procurement, you are not saying you should buy electric cars, you can also buy, for example, a natural gas car, or you can buy an hydrogen car if ever available. So there are, you should never make a prescription of the specific technology, but take into consideration standards and then let the market provide the answer.
And again, I think we are talking about coordination, because public procurement is done at the national level, or even sometimes at the regional level, or even sometimes for municipal police at the local level. So here it's more about coordinating in Europe the standards, for instance, that all those public procurement needs to fulfill, and not doing it at the EU level, because we know that the EU budget is very small and the public procurement for EU budget is almost non-existent.
Well, if you were wondering about high Italian public debt, it might be because the police are driving around in Lamborghinis.
Some of them.
Let's move on to our fourth pillar, because I've heard the word disruption being thrown around a lot this afternoon. And I think the word disruption has got rather a negative reputation in the last two or three years. It's mainly associated with changing people's way of life very quickly. I think it's associated with populism in many ways, and people feeling somewhat lacking in agency in their local communities and so on. Now, something as radical as the challenge ahead of us will inevitably, the benefits of that will not be spread out in a geographically equal way. And it might not be spread out in a way that is equal for different sections of society and classes. So the fourth pillar of this European Green Deal paper is about the political consequences of this revolution.
So social even consequences.
Yes, social consequences.
Because it's true that actually we already wrote a blueprint about this last year with my colleague Georg, who is also a co-author of this paper, on the distributional impact of climate policies. And basically and we looked at all the potential climate policies that exist or that should exist. And basically what we showed in that book is that most of them are actually regressive. So we know that the climate policy...
So explain to us what is regressive.
So that basically people from low income part of the population are more affected than people from high income part of the population. So what we and that we give a lot of examples there. Like for example, think about taxes on fuel, on road fuels. We know actually that people from the lower part of the income distribution use a bigger part of their income on road fuels. So basically, if we put a tax on road fuels, they will be most affected. That's the same with taxes on heating, with taxes on electricity, all those taxes. So the low-income households spend much more of their income on those elements, and therefore they are more affected. So there is a big side effect of those climate policies, but inaction is not an option. Actually, we need to tackle climate change, so we need to put in place those climate policies. Most of those climate policies are actually disruptive, as you said, and therefore we need to accompany those climate policies with social policies.
Also starting, for example, from the measures that are actually progressive, because if you think about energy efficiency in social housing, that would immediately result in lower energy bills for the people living there, which would be actually a progressive measure. So
yeah, actually, this is one of the only climate policies that we find is as progressive. We say taxing aviation is one, so we should maybe do that. Yeah. And the second one, is investment. So again, you see that those pillars are connected.
Wait, why is taxing aviation progressive?
Because people
fly more than the poor. Yeah,
exactly.
But wait, we're going to go back to like the 1980s or 90s, where only middle class people can afford to go on holiday.
But that's why actually the investment pillar is very important, because middle class people could actually use other way to travel, like at high speed train that are electricity alimented.
Well, for example, I teach in Italy at the university, and last week I was flying to Bologna for my course, and I was calculating, looking at my ticket, how much a 40 euro per ton of CO2 carbon tax would impact my my ticket. 4 euros.
Four euros
only. And I mean, that would not.
So, but that tells course. That tells me basically 40 euros is not enough as a price, right? Because you won't change your behavior for four
Absolutely.
Euros.
Yeah. So we need a much higher price. But even if by starting with such measures, you could invest massively in offsetting, which would at least provide a short-term solution to part of this problem. Because if you now decide to offset your ticket, you can opt for €1 more for the offsetting. €4, you can do 4 times more of offsetting in case.
The offsetting measures, yeah,
offsetting
to the
measures.
Extent that these measures actually work, I mean, which is often debated.
Absolutely.
But okay, let's talk a bit about what can we do about the redistributional consequences of this revolution. I mean, so you pointed out it's regressive, so the poor are affected more than the rich. Some countries, poorer countries, are more affected than richer countries. Yeah. Because the poorer countries have more poor people than the richer countries. And so in that sense, the emission trading system probably as it is already has even not only distributional consequences at the national level, but also across countries, right? I mean, poorer countries find it more difficult to cope with climate change than richer countries, because for them it's essential to still grow. So what is the kind of set of EU policies and national policies that you foresee in your paper? Can you just walk us through the main sort of policy recommendations?
Yeah, but the first one, Simone already mentioned it, is basically designing less regressive climate policies. So focusing on the ones that are less regressive, like aviation tax, investment in social housing, etc. That's our first pillar. The second one is actually compensating people. And actually we say that the extra money that will come from increasing prices of carbon need to be used to compensate people. And some countries are actually doing it. Switzerland is doing it. British Columbia in Canada is actually doing it. It can be done differently. In Switzerland, for instance, it's done in a lump sum way. So basically everybody receives the same amount of money. So,
and just to explain to our listeners why would that help? I mean, so basically, I pay more for my car trip to my daily trip to work because of higher fuel prices, and then I get money to be able to afford paying more. So why would I change my behavior?
But because it changed relative prices. So basically,
well,
you
explain
will,
that please so, a bit. So,
okay, so basically, you receive the money that you spent on higher car fuel, but also car looks less advantageous than using public transport, for instance. So the relative prices.
So you want to make some savings, basically. So,
but I think the answer is also that you don't want to change the behavior of these people, because you use these options when alternatives are not there. That's why these options are very important. These compensation measures are very important, for example, in rural areas, because there is no way of changing behavior of people because they do not have alternatives. If you don't have the public transport
system. That's the investment
system,
side. You need investment.
Need both.
Yeah, but you need both. You need both, and you need these compensatory measures, at least in the short term, if the price of carbon is going to be up.
So basically, compensation is also to avoid the political backlash.
Yeah, exactly.
And investment is really to change the behavior. So both are complementary. You want to avoid what you want to avoid the backlash, because otherwise politicians will never.
No, but the change of behavior comes also from the change in the price, right? So
from both. Okay, so now it's a three pillar.
You and see, you can all also, of this is, and you can also imagine a reduction in the compensation as the alternatives will grow and materialize, such as the public transport systems.
Well, that's going to be a bit of a hard sell, isn't it? Taking the compensation away as time goes on. Surely once you start it, it's going to be really hard to withdraw it.
But anyway, actually, if you finance this compensation with the money from carbon taxes, then anyway the money that will be used to compensate will go down. So politicians, I think, need to be really clear about this.
Well, but I mean, let's say the social measures, I mean, the compensatory measures are basically funded out of your budget, right? I mean, so governments have budgets and they have certain social policies. And what you're saying is, well, at the moment when you introduce a CO2 tax on, let's say, transport fuel, you will want to reduce the untaxed minimum income, for example, right? Yeah. So you will say, instead of leaving the bottom €6,000 untaxed, you leave the bottom €7,000 untaxed.
British Columbia is doing, for
so instance. So that's a very simple measure, but it's a general tax measure, right? So So the budget in the end is still has to add up. So and I think, as Nicolas says, I mean, so once people have these benefits, you can't take them away, right?
That's why politicians have to be very transparent. They have to say, okay, this compensation comes from that money. And therefore, when that money will disappear because we are not emitting CO2 anymore, then you will not be compensated. Well, so transparency and accountability is very important.
You tax somebody else. You tax the rich afterwards with something else.
No, because actually the tax because basically the compensation and the tax on CO2 are equal. So you don't need that money to do something else. You need that money only to compensate people.
Yeah, I also wanted to flag that this is, of course, a very important component of the social dimension of the Green Deal, which is how to compensate the low-income households for the climate policy we put in place. But there is also another component, which is really more looking at the regions, because there are regions in Europe that will be affected in a more substantial manner by these decarbonization plans than other regions. And this is notably the case of coal mining regions in Europe. This has been a long-lasting issue, and this is also a key driver for certain countries, such as Poland, not to embrace yet the 2050 climate neutrality target at the EU level. Now, we in the paper looked into the numbers and really came up with the idea that this issue is very limited in either geographically and in size. So this means that Europe can provide a solution for this issue with a facility, the European Globalization Adjustment Fund, that is already there. And it should be just scaled up and also applied to this decarbonization purpose. Just to give you one number, it is estimated that 160,000 jobs will be lost by 2030 in the coal sector in Europe if we keep up with our decarbonization trajectory. Well, out of these 160,000, 110,000 jobs, so most of them, will be lost in any case due to the fact that these jobs are not competitive anymore vis-a-vis, for example, the Chinese market. Again, in Italy nowadays, we are seeing a big crisis concerning a factory, Ilva in Taranto, which is the largest steel maker in Europe. More than 20,000 jobs are involved in this issue, and ArcelorMittal seems to be willing to run away from these commitments they previously took. This is not due to climate policy or to decarbonization, but is due to the fact that other steel makers in the world, notably in China and India, are more competitive than that particular production. Should have this happening under, for example, a stronger climate policy in Italy, all this discussion would have immediately framed under the slogan, okay, this is the effect of climate policy, this is a distributional effect, which is not. So we need to be very cautious about diversifying which jobs we are losing because of competitive nature and which ones for the climate policy. In any case, in the case of the coal mining regions, numbers are limited. And by using tools that we already have in the European budget, Europe can provide a contribution for the retraining, the reskilling of these people, and this would prove to be a formidable way to convince countries to back this plan, because we are going to stand with them and support them in the transition of these regions.
And also that's why we think that creating a new fund is not useful, and using the EGF, and also adjustment due to climate mitigation, sometimes it might be difficult to see where it comes from. So actually combining the two and having a more general European adjustment fund that do both is much much smarter.
Because the phenomena are really similar, specular, and two sides of the same coin, basically.
And actually, it's also a way to improve active labor market policies in Europe. Because actually, when we wrote a paper a long time ago on the EGF, we noticed
European Globalization Fund.
European Globalization Adjustment Fund, we saw that active labor market policies, so policies to retrain people that lose their job, are very different across Europe. And actually, having a fund that finances that and also encourage to share best practices is a way to to harmonize these policies in Europe and to use the good policies that have been developed, for instance, in Scandinavia, and use them also in Italy, in France, in Germany, etc.
By the way, we had exactly a similar fund in the 50s in Europe under the coal and steel community. It was a fund for the retraining and reskilling of people that were losing their jobs in these two sectors. And this fund lately became the European Social Fund. So is history 2.0.
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult because I think of areas of the north of England where a generation ago, thousands of people were employed in coal mines. And now they have huge wind turbines just off the coast. But the people who maintain them, they come into the city once a week or once a month. They spend one night in a hotel, they go out on the boat, they check the wind turbines, then they leave. And it does very little for the local economy. So I think it's going to be very
That's
difficult.
Why retraining those people, maybe it was not done in the UK, and maybe that's a problem.
I just don't know if it takes the same manpower to provide all that energy. Anyway, before I liberate you all, I'm just going to pose one more question about the way this is done, because the European Union has obviously pledged to be carbon neutral by 2050, but so has the United Kingdom. They've passed a law to be completely carbon neutral by 2050. So this will be an interesting kind of test of whether the supranational body is more effective or less effective than the nation state in doing this. So
if Brexit happens.
If Brexit happens, yes. But why should we be optimistic or pessimistic about the ability of the European Union, all these competing interests? I mean, any European Green Deal will have to survive at least six electoral tests between now and 2050. I naturally think that countries need to come together to solve this because it's a global challenge, but we also have the more seats at the table, the more people there are to veto it and water down legislation. So should we be optimistic about the European Union's ability to solve this?
In my view, yes, for many reasons, but just let me give you one, is air pollution. All these measures will not just impact climate change positively, of course, in the sense of mitigating climate change, but all these measures will also improve the local environment. They will clean up the air we breathe every day, and this is something that people care and people can see every day. So I think that this is a formidable, tool, leverage for politicians, because you can reframe all these discussions into air pollution prevention and fight against air pollution, and this will really provide you a big deal of support. The other dimension is honesty and transparency, as Gregory said before. If you, as a politician, can clearly say to the people, look, this change is going to happen in any case, like it or not, let's manage it in a way that diminishes the social consequences and try to make the best out of it, I think that sooner or later people will come to the recognition that this is really a fundamental reallocation mechanism.
No, and to come back to your original question, I think both are needed, the national and the supranational. In a way, climate change, it's a global problem, so we need coordination. So of course we will need a member state to do most of the work, but coordination is absolutely important. Otherwise, nothing gets done.
Well, I would add an optimistic and a pessimistic note. The optimistic note is that we not only have a plan, we've seen that in some cases the EU at least has been less captured by national production and industrial interests. You can certainly see that in the case of the German car industry, where the standards that were set here were much tougher than would ever have been possible in the German parliament. Now, the reason for pessimism is, and that's where the UK is going to be an interesting test example, is the common agricultural policy. I mean, we know we haven't talked much about this, but we know agriculture is also a major climate issue. And we know that the European agricultural policy is actually a very bad policy for biodiversity, for climate policy, and for many other things. And we haven't seen much change, and I don't see much change, unfortunately. And the UK, in turn, has a strong debate on how it could actually have a different agricultural policy. So it's going to be an interesting test case to compare the UK and the EU on that dimension for sure.
Well, you can read Bugle's plan for the European Union's response, and that's called How to Make the European Green Deal Work. It is at bugle.org. Please go and read it. Thank you, Simone. Thank you, Gregory. Thank you, Guntram. We have 11,007 days before 2050. Good luck.